today on Building the Open Metaverse.
And the metaverse, by the way, is only whatever we think about the word, right? It's only creating more appetite for creators and companies alike to like have more content. And when you think about it also, like, I was thinking about it the other day, but maybe I'm late to the game, but I was realizing, well, actually there is no limit in there. I mean, there is a limited space on Earth. So there is a limited amount of things that we can do with land, with, I don't know, number of shoes or number of objects we can sell and manufacture. And by the way, we should be very careful about what we do with the land and what we build and what how we exploit the Earth and all. But when in the virtual space, of course, it's using energy as a trade-off. But when it comes to the space itself, if it's virtual infinite.
Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, where technology experts discuss how the community is building the open metaverse together. Hosted by Patrick Cozy from Cesium and Mark Petit from Epic Games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our show, Building the Open Metaverse, the podcast where technologists share their insight on how the community is building the metaverse together. My name is Mark Petit from Epic Games, and my co-host is Patrick Cozy from Cesium. Patrick, how are you?
Hi, Mark. Doing fantastic. Looking forward to today's topic.
Yeah, today we have another very special guest. You know, he founded his company straight out of school more than 20 years ago and has had a deep impact on the computer graphics industry. And he now holds a position that will allow him to make even more of an impact on that industry as he's leading 3D development at Adobe. So it's my pleasure to welcome Sébastien Deguy, founder of Algorithmic and VP for 3D and Immersive at Adobe. Welcome, Sébastien.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Patrick, to have me today. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, no, we're super happy to have you with us. So, Sébastien, you're both a scientist and an entrepreneur and a musician and a bunch of other things. We won't talk about it here. But, you know, in your own words, please tell us your journey to the metaverse and how you got where you are today. I think it's fascinating for people.
Okay. Well, so it's a long journey, as you say. Like, I completed my PhD more than 20 years ago. Actually, last December was the 20th anniversary of my PhD. It's been a long time coming, I would say. But yeah, so as you say, I created Algorithmic just after I completed my PhD, and just before I completed, I actually started my PhD. I was very passionate about computer graphics, video games, movies, a lot of things, like everything images, really. And I remember, like, in my room back in France, and you've been there as well, but basically trying to catch every piece of information about this space and computers. And at the time, it was very complicated because I was living on the countryside. So I would need to actually asked my mother to bring me to a kiosk and buy magazines about computer science or mostly games, actually, I have to admit. But basically, yeah, it started there. I started like developing a very strong passion for it. I even developed a very small program that takes two input videos and turned that into an anaglyph, you know, the ones that you wear, like a cyan and a red glass, and you see in relief. So I started trying to apply what I knew about computers and computer graphics and computer science into how to make movies, how to make visual effects, and have fun with it. So I started there, and then I studied math and applied math, and I did a PhD in applied math and computer science in this field of random processes. And one cool application of the mathematical model I was working on at the time was used for simulating complex phenomena like clouds. But one thing you could also do is, if you don't do a cloud in volume, which also at the time on computers at the time was complicated to generate because you needed a lot of computational power, you could generate 2D images of such clouds. And when looking at these 2D images, you would see what you call noises now in computer graphics. And I'd been asked to teach a program that was called Softimage 3D before Softimage XSI. Actually, you know that very well, Mark, but Softimage 3D.
I know a thing or two about it, yes.
Yeah, a thing or two. Softimage 3D, basically, I was asked to teach that tool, and it was late 90s. And so at the time, it was the best you can find out there, right? It was an amazing tool, and I had to learn it before I actually teached it, so I was one week ahead of my students. But basically, what I saw in the tool was you had these ateliers or steps in the process. You had the modeling, you had the animation, you had the rendering, and on the rendering side of things, you could apply textures and materials, and one way to achieve that was to use noise functions. And at the time, there was like the fractal noise, the whirly noise, the purling noise, and all the noises you know now. And actually, I made the connection, the first connection I made between my research and the world of computer graphics was at that time, because I realized, okay, what I find in Softimage 3D and what I can do with my prototype, like trying to simulate clouds, actually, I could do the same and more. So I started thinking, maybe, oh, wait a minute, it's really a passion of mine, and maybe I could apply the research I'm doing for this specific field. So I started talking in the field of computer graphics about the math behind it. And then the head of the R&D from Buff company, Xavier Beck, contacted me, and he said, he told me, like, oh, how do you do that? Like, come and tell us a little bit about what you do. And so this is where it planted a bug in my ear, basically, of, okay, maybe there is an interest from the actual world of VFX, which I was completely mad about, and the world of science I was having in, my PhD in, right? So as soon as I completed my PhD, I started the project of building a company that would become Allegorithmic. At the time, I thought it would take like 2 years and two guys to just come up with something that was maybe like Guy's Power Tools. I don't know if you remember that one, but that was like just having fun and producing cool stuff. And it took 10 years and more years, in fact, but 10 years before we actually got some success out of it. And a lot more people than two, a lot more trouble as well. But yeah, fast forward, then we started a company in 2003 officially. And completed my PhD end of 2001, started the company a year and a half later. And then we grew with what became, Allegorithmic. At the time we joined Adobe in 2019. We were 140 people when we joined. And in the meantime, we created the tools that are known as Substance, and especially as Substance Designer, Substance Painter, and then Substance Sampler and more. And the Substance Source library of materials. And so we focused on really applying the math that was developed, like the noise functions, and then like expanding to everything, materials and textures. And Substance Designer started to have success in 2011, in fact, 2012 even. So it took really 10 years, yeah, to get to a point where it started to have an impact, mostly in games at first, not VFX, to my dismay, but then came back to the VFX world, and now all the Substance tools are used by like 90, like last time we did the count, it was 97% of AAA game developers, and most, for the past 5 years, I think like all the VFX Oscars winners use Substance in some form, like sometimes short, like things here and there, but then a lot more with Dune and or Blade Runner and this type of movies anyway. So sorry, it was a long answer. But and then in 2019 we joined Adobe, right, and we started this new division called 3D Immersive. Right, I don't know, maybe too long.
No, I mean I can attest that when I was at Autodesk, you were coming like every year or every 6 months actually, dropping by Montreal and showing us and what you were doing, and the progress was there. And I think the thing I remember that was very specific about what you and Allegorithmic is the kind of support you got from the team. I mean, everybody, even if there was not a lot at the beginning, there was always a lot of beliefs that you guys were onto something big, and we did the Flame deal, if you remember, and all of those things. It's been, I think what people need to realize is how much resilience you need to have. You know, it's, again, an overnight success, 10 years in the making, something like this. And I, Sebastian, I remember that you've been so, so resilient. You've been there, so humble every time, coming back every 6 months, showing progress. And I think that built the credibility and the trust in people that I think, and they are willing to stand up for you when you need them to stand up. So
Exactly. It's very good to hear because definitely, you know, by the way, I started writing just like some kind of a book for algorithmic, just for me to part of the reason why I went into random processes at the very beginning is that I had an accident and lost some part of my memory. And so I got very interested in like this idea of memory and randomness and are we predictable, because I remember going through a phase where I would go through the exact same cycle of questions after the accident, go through the exact same cycle of questions and ended up with the same joke because I was in the same environment. So every 3 minutes, my father would tell me like I was waiting for the MRI and I would like, where am I? What happened? And then a joke, something like, and then 3 minutes later, where am I? What happened? And then the same joke. So I realized, okay, are we predictable somehow? So I started like asking myself the question, does randomness exist really? And my PhD advisor at the time told me like, welcome, finally, or you're one of us, right? Asking the right question, does it exist? And so I studied it. Anyway, so I started writing this because it's a good excuse for me to say, well, I had an accident, so I have memory issues now. But like, anyway, so I'm writing this thing and I found a very old photograph. It's funny you mentioned this, Mark, because a very old photograph, whereas there is the Autodesk, I think it was a discrete booth even at the time. And I'm sitting on the edge of the photo. You see some guy like lying on the ground, sitting there with a huge laptop. That was me. And I remember, okay, I must have been waiting for you to talk to me or be able to have a chance to talk to you and show you the stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, to your point, it takes a lot of time. And it took a lot of time for us. I'm not saying it's a general rule, but it took a lot of time. It took a lot of resilience. That's very true too. And I think if there is one thing, it's this one. And it's, of course, you need luck. Of course, you need to be good at what you're doing. But at some point, you need to work and be resilient. And so it's the big one.
So Patrick, let's geek out now.
For sure. So Seb, first, yeah, I mean, congrats on all your accomplishments in both research and in business. These are great lessons learned. Thank you for sharing them with the community. But let's jump into Substance. I mean, can you tell us more about what the end users do with it, how it incorporates your research, you know, what problems it solves?
Right. So Substance today, I mean, like for the texturing products, and now we have more products, but the texturing products allow for people to create what we call textures or material or digital materials, which is when you model a 3D scene, a 3D environment, you go with like the shape first. Like we've seen like these empty, naked shapes in 3D floating in a 3D space. But then when you want to give it the aspect of wood, you want to give it the aspect of skin or fabric or any material that there is in real life, when you want to have something realistic or not, but like that looks like it's a wood or an expression thereof, you need what we call textures, which are images that you apply onto and you wrap onto your 3D object. And these images describe how the light will interact with that surface and giving you, your eye and your brain, the impression of, okay, this is wood because I recognize the colors, I recognize the patterns, I recognize the way it's the specularity or how it's reflected, if it is or transparent it is, etc. So we have a few tools dedicated to this specific area, which is a very narrow and niche area, but it's necessary in every 3D world and representation or experience. And so so Substance Designer is a very technical tool that lets you do that with a node-based approach, a procedural approach that has its advantages. And then Substance Painter is some kind of a Photoshop in 3D where you have a layer stack. And instead of painting with color on a 2D canvas, you paint with materials on a 3D object. And so you extend somehow the idea of the artistic gesture and the Photoshop like workflow in 3D. And so artists have been like loving the tool for that reason, because it's not the first one to be able to do that, but I was one of the first one, if not the first one, to actually be a truly completely GPU powered full 3D full material painting application. So you would paint the whole all the layers, all the the information textures at the same time in one stroke, right? And so it was non-destructive, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have Substance Sampler that lets you, from an input, among other things, it can let you do many things, but one thing can allow you is, and it's very strong about, is like take one picture of a material that you like in the street and turn that into a full material in a very simple way. So this is for the materials part, and so that's historically what Substance has been about, right? And now we have more products.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it completely blurs the limit between surface geometry and shading. I mean, you can add stitches, you can add a level of details to your object, and simplify the process of creating the shape. So it's been fascinating to see, you know, the sophistication of that technology. Actually, you've been for 20 years at it. Is there still a lot of innovation to be done in that space? Are you running out of problems to solve? Or?
Well, I think we will never run out of problems to solve, either in that field or others. But it's a fairly mature. It's interesting because the 3D space as a whole is not that mature, and so there is still a lot of innovation to be developed. Which is interesting. Also, it's a bit of a curse because that means that we're a little bit far still from total democratization, because you still need a good GPU, you still need a good hardware, you still need a good input, you still need interactivity. And so there are ways to reach this via new ways, but it's still very demanding. It's a demanding space, and it's a complex space as well, because there is one more dimension. It's involving way more complexity between in terms of interactions and filters and all the mathematical functions you can apply in this space. Anyway, but when it comes to texturing, there are still many things to work on, and standardization is one. How to make sure that we have more complex and more complete ways of describing some surfaces that we're bad at describing right now. We've been doing a lot of progresses in the past years, especially thanks to the physically based rendering techniques and the mechanism that and schemas that have been developed. But yeah, there is still a lot to be done. And now, of course, it's converging a little bit, right? And so it's less of a complete blue ocean open to total reinvention, but still a lot of fun to have, I would say.
So, Seb, given how widely used Substance is, I mean, it feels like it's really the de facto standard, right, for describing these materials and textures. Have you thought about open sourcing parts of it?
So, yes, we always have the discussion, and how the framework we have in mind is always the same. Like, how can we help the ecosystem? Right, and so I think we're all on the same page in that sense. So how do we help the ecosystem? Of course, we're a business, so how do we help the ecosystem in which every actor has to find its way, and including us, right? So it's an ecosystem in a sense that it has to benefit everybody. And so we always try to find, okay, well, are there any ways to make sure that, for instance, the Substance format itself could be used more widely, and lately, I don't know if you've seen, but we made available the SDK for the Substance engine. So now anyone can just like go to adobe.io, I think it's the address, and you can download the SDK, and you have all the documentation, and you can write your own plugin to plug your own application with, connect your own application with the Substance engine so that you can then generate the texture. So it's a start. It's the first step. We very much like the open source community for various reasons, and we support it. We actually provide a lot of support to a lot of open source initiatives. We don't talk about all of them, but like we do support all the ones that we use for like an obvious reason. And then we try to support more. Like and lately we've been supporting Blender, which is a good example as well. And we have also help like develop this bridge between the Blender and the Substance applications, because a lot of actually our users are using Blender as well. And so the format itself, we've been looking into it, and we really, it's always on the table. We keep like turning around, like deciding or not deciding. Lately, what happened with MaterialX USD and other formats, but USD and Material Access especially is of the highest interest to us, because maybe finally we're onto something that any company could use, and we could exchange things. And the reality of things, back to what I was saying before, we're still in the early age, I feel, of the metaverse and 3D and experiences. I feel like there's still so much to be done. And you, as a user, what we see is that they usually, studios mix a lot of tools coming from different, lot of companies. So if we just want, just being realistic and honest with our user and clients, we have to take into account the fact that they won't stay in Adobe-only products, and they won't stay into, I don't know, any other company-only products. Usually there are, it flows, right? So it has to flow. And so finally, maybe with USD and Material X, we're onto something that could be leading to a place where, yeah, I mean, like all these materials, all these models, or potentially all these experiences could flow.
So do you think you could, in the current state of Material X, you could transport all of the sophistication of the substance content?
Not everything right now, but we try to make sure that it's easily feasible if you have some kind of a substance extension to Material X somehow. But yeah, I mean, like the discussions are ongoing about like, should we want to make that more by a default thing? And if so, do we need to open source it? Do we need to open it? So these discussions are ongoing. But yeah, definitely, it's we see the interest. We don't want to fall into traps, also for legal reasons. It's a complicated thing, but definitely on the table, yeah.
That's great to hear, I mean, because SBSR file are kind of the, you know, right now the de facto standard, so.
So, Seb, in general, I love your perspective on ecosystems and trying to rise the tide for all ships and kind of connect all the parts there, so great work.
And I think it's one thing we like to underline in this podcast is how people like to work together in our industry, because it's a given for us, because we've grown, you know, we went to SIGGRAPH, and we know that we like to work together. And even though we work in competing companies, we're made of the same wood. I mean, we're part of the same community. But it's not true of every industry, by the way. And I think it's something we need to celebrate of our industry and carry into the metaverse, is that appetite for collaboration. We can compete and collaborate and, you know, may the best man win. But I won't name industries, but we all know other industries where data hoarding and there is no spirit of openness and collaboration, actually. But it will change.
I agree. I agree with you. We should celebrate this, because to your point, like we're of the same way. We've all been passionate and like fascinated by the first movies, right? When I saw Tron, when I saw Jurassic Park or Terminator, we all were in awe with what we saw. And same goes for the computer graphic and computer games and video games. I mean, it's of course we do compete, yes, but also we have the luxury of having this fast expanding space. So I think there is space for everybody. So if we're smart, there is space for a lot of people and a lot of companies and a lot of ways to address that demand of creators willing to adopt that space, right? So and enter that space. So it's and the metaverse, by the way, is only whatever we think about the word, right? It's only creating more appetite for creators and companies alike to like have more content. And when you think about it, also, like I was thinking about it the other day, but I'm late to the game, but I was realizing, well, actually there is no limit in there. I mean, there is a limited space on Earth. So there is a limited amount of things that we can do with land, with, I don't know, number of shoes or number of objects we can sell and manufacture. And by the way, we should be very careful about what we do with the land and what we build and how we exploit the earth and all. But when in the virtual space, of course, it's using energy as a trade-off. But when it comes to the space itself, if it's virtually infinite, so there is an opportunity we've never a scale. For this opportunity that the human being has never encountered before, when you think about it. So it's really, it gives me vertigo sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, and it'll create many orders of magnitude of opportunity. So as you said, you know, it's going to be a boon for all of us at all of our companies. So So let's switch gear a little bit and talk about your company. So Adobe is a relative newcomer to 3D. You mentioned, you know, it really started with the acquisition of Algorithmic in 2019. But they seem to be now moving by leaps and bounds under your leadership. So what are your goals for the division that you created, and what role does Adobe want to play in the metaverse?
So, yeah, I mean, Adobe has always been interested in 3D. There has been a lot of initiatives actually along the years, like for quite some time. But it was always limited by, I would say, the internal appetite for that space, which was seen as very technical, maybe too narrow, too nascent for a company like Adobe. But the way it's seen now, it has changed in the last year or so, or 2.5 years. I mean, 3 years, because like with the acquisition, yes, actually it was the first. I mean, it wasn't the first one, but it was a significant move towards, yes, we want to build something. And because at the same time my company was acquired, this new division, 3D Immersive, was created, and I had the chance to lead that. And it, basically in that division, we gathered all like initiatives, almost all, and then we could hire more people. We could acquire a company from Oculus called Medium, a small tool that is becoming Modeler, and we could grow from there. And that, like, we working on integrating, and then we release something. So it has changed very quickly in the last year, because a few things happened. One is we released the first offering that Adobe has done in the world of 3D, which is called Adobe Substance 3D. So we released something which is already something special. It takes so much work to release something in big corporation like this, and to integrate and connect and make sure that everybody's aware and like working. And when we sell, it's actually bringing in money. And so, and it's legal, etc. Right? So there's a lot of work involved there. And then it went well. So that means that we constantly surpassed our objectives, which also is a good thing, because that's showing traction in industry, and that's showing that we didn't aim wrong. We aimed right, in fact, with our tools and pricing and way of communicating. And then also a lot of companies came to us and said, Adobe, we love you. We'd like to go 3D now. So what I hear, you're doing something. Can you tell us more? And so when Shantanu, our CEO, hears about this, it's great, because he's seeing that there is some momentum again in the industry. And some of these big companies are setting the tone for the future. And not only in entertainment, by the way, it can be in product design and everything. And then the metaverse happened. And then the metaverse, I mean, not happened, but like the craziness and the change of name of Facebook from Facebook to Meta. I mean, it put so much like eyeballs on the subject. And then what happened is that the market, Wall Street, and the analysts started to ask companies like Adobe, but not only ours, but what is your play in the metaverse? And so we needed to have something. So we were like in the back, waving our hands and saying, well, we're ready. We know what we should be doing. And we've been successful, and you've seen the traction, etc. So anyway, now is a different time, because Adobe sees that as the next big thing. And the same way Adobe has been trying to support creatives and companies embrace this new digital printing revolution at the time, with PostScript and then PDF, and then digital imaging with Photoshop and more, Illustrator, and then video with Premiere and After Effects, etc., etc. This new space of 3D and the metaverse, call it the way you want, is definitely a new space where Adobe understands, okay, well, there will be a need to go there. Creatives want to embrace that space. We, as Adobe, our DNA is to empower the creatives and the designers of the world who want to embrace that new space, right? So it's the only natural evolution for Adobe. It took time. But then, because it took time, it became really something organic and very deep. And now it's very deep and very rooted. And I have the chance to be at the right space at the right time right now, right spot at the right time, because we're supported. We announced an acquisition on Monday, a few days ago. And it's hopefully only the beginning. I mean, it's compared to Epic and other companies, of course. We haven't announced that many acquisitions in the past, but it's happening. It's more organic. But it's very rooted now. And so yeah, I mean, it's great to be in that position now, because yeah, Adobe is very serious about it.
actually, we can talk about this. And congrats on acquiring Brio VR as company founded by Dave Cardwell, who was the founder of Mudbox. I know well. I bought his first company, SkyMatter, when I was at Autodesk. Great gang of people. It's all web. Patrick, it's all web-based technology. I mean, it's all web GPU renderings and product visualization and VR. So what are you going to do with this, Sebastian?
So with this one, it's interesting because it's twofold. I mean, the interest is threefold. First, it's amazing talent, right? And so that Dave himself is a very interesting guy and incredibly interesting, in fact. And the whole team, like Kushik and Jacqueline, they've been building something very special, and they're special. So we wanted to grow, and so it's a great way to grow with talent very quickly. And that level of the caliber of the people there is amazing. And so then it's twofold, like the interest, we've seen a lot of interest for 3D experiences and 3D configuration and in the world of commerce. And so we wanted to expand what we were doing on the web. We already have something, but we wanted to go a little bit one step further, basically, right? So that's the objective here, is to make sure we have the technology stack and the talent so that we can come up with something that allows for more web-based workflows and that we can empower leverage the web and potentially the cloud as well, which is something that we're not very good at right now. We have desktop applications, and so we needed to expand our knowledge, expand the team, and get more technologies and potentially products. So yeah, I mean, the goal here is to again connect the world of 3D creativity that is very deep and rich and that can use our tools with more people and more use cases, in fact. And some of these use cases have to be web first. Let's put it this way.
And so you have a complete set of products now. You have announced Modeler, you have announced Stager. So what's the vision and where do you think this is going? A new creative cloud?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny because when we started discussing with Adobe a long time before the acquisition, even, like, we were really liking this ecosystem approach of theirs, right, and of ours now. And something we appreciated was the fact that it was a galaxy of tools instead of a universal tool. And because it both had their advantages, right? But a universal tool, you can only stretch it so thin. At some point, it breaks. And if you wanted to make it too many things, it becomes really complicated to manage, like, both vertical and horizontal at the same time. So it's well, this is my view anyway, but they're counter examples that work very well. But if you want to go a little bit further than the current community of 3D creators, we feel you have to have potentially more specific, focused, smaller, dedicated tools that connect well with each other, again, and in an ecosystem approach, a galaxy of tools. And so, yeah, the Creative Cloud of 3D is, yes, because we have many tools already. And you said it, like, we have a new modeling application, a sculpting modeling application in Modeler, which is going to be, I mean, it's amazing already what the guys have been doing. We have people coming from the Medium team and Dreams also. And so, and with us around, we just, like, watch them and we basically give them food and water and we just, like, adapt to what they come up with because it's really amazing. So that will be a good one. But it can do only so much. So if you want to have, like, potentially polygonal modeling, like the good old ways, and control to every up to every triangle, maybe it's not the best tool for that. So you still need something else. But then for some people, for some use cases, this might become the best tool.
Sure. Ever. And for the rest, you have Blender.
I assume that. And then for the rest, you have Blender, exactly, or other tools. So what we're missing still is animation. We have MixMO, but it's it hasn't been evolving a lot in the past years, unfortunately, whereas it's used by so many people. It's crazy, actually. It's one of the biggest success in the 3D world. And so many people use it. It needs a little bit of a refresh when it comes to the technology and things. And so we're looking at it as well, and we're looking into what to do with it. So, yeah, now we have Stager then, which is like this simple staging rendering application. What you guys have been starting doing with... how's it called? Sorry. The your tool
Twinmotion.
Twinmotion, thank you. Yeah, so Twinmotion, same idea, like how to simplify, how to streamline a staging step, like a PowerPoint for 3D somehow, where you can import very quickly, place very quickly, snap objects and have physics and that kind of thing like together, so to create an image very quickly, right? Or an experience for that matter. And so Stager is this one, and we developed a very fast path tracer that connects very well with all the nice material definitions that we have, and some of the latest development that we did with research as well as Adobe Research on the interactive displacement, micro displacement technique, which is absolutely amazing. Also, one thing that we developed for hair and fur lately that we showcased, we did a sneak peek last week. So the idea here is to get to an image that is as realistic, as compelling as possible for of a scene or an object, and that's Stager. But yeah, for animation, for character animation, we have nothing right now. So, but the goal, to answer your question, the goal eventually is to get to a point where you have as many options as possible in what we offer. I don't expect it to be anywhere complete in the next very years, because it first takes time. And then again, back to the point I was making before, I think what we don't want to, we want to allow people to go somewhere else and come back if they have to, or go somewhere else and then stay somewhere else. But at least at some point they use our tools and that's fine. So yeah, the goal is to have this complete offering end to end. And one good thing about Adobe is the connection with the Creative Cloud, so the actual 2D products. So being able to connect very quickly with Photoshop or Illustrator, which we do already with a tool like Sampler, Substance Sampler. It's amazing that connection that can happen, because that's bringing a lot to the table. And then on the other side of the spectrum is what everything Adobe is doing on the delivery side of thing with AEM and these type of tools with analytics. For companies, like let's say a product company, willing to have feedback on their offers and their experiences that they, and the images or the 3D experiences that they have on the website for their products, it's great if it's 2D or 3D, right? So it's, for them, it's actually better if it's 3D also, as well. So there is a connection to be done here. So it's a lot of work. But that's the good thing about a company like Adobe, because of Creative Cloud and the Marketing Cloud as well.
So, Seb, we appreciate everything you're doing to empower more and more creators. I mean, we agree with you that we want everyone to be a creator, and we see that theme, you know, with the metaverse and across the podcast. Your approach of having kind of several products that are focused and interoperable is interesting. I wanted to switch gears just a little. So earlier you explained how you're doing procedural textures in a 3D context. And I wanted to ask, are you applying any procedural to the 3D modeling, to creating the actual surfaces, whether it's for the hair you just mentioned or maybe the displacements?
Yes, so absolutely. Procedural techniques are at the heart of everything we've been doing. And we love procedural approaches, right? So a year ago, I think like maybe 9 months ago, yeah, we integrated in Substance Designer, the ability to export meshes, right? Procedural meshes as well. And so you can do that to some degree in Substance Designer already today. And it's evolving fast. We also have internal research projects that are mind-blowing about along this idea of again parametric generation of content and models. Modeler is also using an SDF approach, right? So it's very mathematical, although they're turning the tool into something that is like artist first, and so that it's the artists forget about the fact that they're in 3D and they're in volume, in fact, and which is making a lot of sense when you think about it. So they don't have to care about like actually the topology and the triangles, etc. But yeah, I mean, the procedural approach to us has many advantages. First, it's one way to scale, right? So when you have one template definition of one thing, you can generate billions. So that's huge. When you can also have templates, you can have hide the complexity of the thing by exposing only meta parameters that describe some human language described characteristics of a material or a shape now. Let's say more, I don't know, more ripples or less ripples or more knitting or that kind of thing, or more stains or that kind of thing. And so that's also interesting when you think about, back to the point I was making earlier, like bringing access of 3D to more people. There is absolutely a need to have a few step process in between, like the people willing and capable of producing the templates, describing the very process of creation, the procedure, and then people using these procedures and just tweaking a few parameters, but having an eye for what it should be and how it would fit into a scene. Also, one thing we don't talk about that much, which is very important to procedural texturing and procedural content generation in general, is the idea of consistency. When you generate, like for instance, one like on Star Wars, one of the Star Wars, little Star Wars, they were, I think it was, maybe ILM. Basically, they were saying like they needed to generate like humongous numbers of textures. So the scale is important here. But like when you texture not only this type of material but this type of material, and this is done by different people, at least if you follow certain rules that are defined by sub patterns, some sub graphs, then you can control very easily at the end of the process the consistency of them all, right? So for instance, let's say I want a meta parameter that drives the amount of rust on these metals. Maybe if I have like 1,000 models were having 1,000 different materials, procedural materials, then I can have one slider that says like change the rust for all of them, the whole scene now. So it's meta, right? So it's very powerful that way. And so that's I mean, we start seeing this actually happening. So that's very exciting.
It's interesting, and the reason why we like to go proceduralism because we know it's going to play a big role moving forward. But from a standardization perspective, you know, it creates a problem because, you know, you now have to standardize execution or... So Guido, when he was with us a few weeks ago, mentioned that you plan on building all, if not most, if not all of our products on top of the USD Sync Graph. And so, isn't that a bold move from a company like Adobe, given where we are with USD right now?
Yes, it's. I agree with you. This is the objective, and it's so bold that we might take it step by step. And so, not adopting the scene graph in the first place, but maybe just reading in, reading out, right? And so, at least maybe converting into our own data model internally to do our thing, and then exporting to USD and respecting the description model. So, to your point, like the execution side of things. This is where, back to also, by the way, the question about SBSAR, same thing. If you want to control that, you have to have the engine everywhere. So the first step was to open the SDK. And the SDK, so the engine that ensures that the generation is the same everywhere, can be available everywhere, right? So as many places as possible. So this is important because there are many things that we do in the engine that would be a waste of time, I think, to just trying to replicate or just like use the engine itself. So yeah, it's to your point, USD, definitely we see that as a big, big, big opportunity. And Guido being here is important. Obviously, he's been driving this, is the leader of that and one of the founding father of USD. So that's great to have him driving this. But he will come in steps. But some of the newest tools and some of the newest initiatives that we have, they really revolve a lot around USDs. Yeah.
And so one topic that comes around this podcast regularly is, you know, USD is open source library, but it's guided by a single entity, and you know, basically you got a single entity who decides what makes it to the library and what does not. So are you comfortable with that, and how would you like to see this evolve? We've heard a few different versions of that desired evolution. I'm curious to have your take on this. I know it's a bit of an uncomfortable questions, but
it is a bit, because not only because of the very nature of the question, but also in my position, but also the fact that I'm not that opinionated about it actually. So I don't really I would be fine either way, because sometimes I know for a fact that de facto standards can work as well, and I know it's uncomfortable for everyone in that case. versus being uncomfortable to only a few companies. But I mean, both can work. I know we have like very good relationship with Pixar for various reasons. And we work with other companies to make sure that, I mean, to try to enforce one USD and that no strong evolution from and the departure from that very description and that very core idea. So we're working to make sure, we're talking all the time, right? We're talking and trying to make sure that there is no divergence. But yeah, I mean, the short answer is I'm finding a way. I'm not that opinionated, maybe I should be more. But we're trying to make sure that it keeps its promise. And because it could very quickly die if suddenly there is a branch, there is a version that differs from the others, and then there is a separation, then it's over. Then it's one more format, one more standard.
I know, and thanks for your answer. I think it's complex because, like, you know, if you create procedural objects, you would want the proceduralism to be yours because you would support it natively, but then other people may have other ways or and the kind of the other conversation we're having here often is that the other end of the spectrum, you have an open standard, which is not open source library, it's an open standard like GLTF, which seems to work very well and have done wonders in the commerce space. So how important is GLTF to Adobe?
Well, it's super important. We realize that it's spread out and it's used by pretty much everybody. So to us, as an export format, yes, absolutely, we support it, and we've always same thing. I've had like a strong relationship with Kronos and Neil and the whole team there. And so yeah, I mean it's an important aspect to us. So when we say we want to support USD, it's not at the cost of not supporting anything else. Definitely USD, we see that as an authoring format. And USDZ or NGLTF definitely has output format for any type of applications. Yes, absolutely. These are the two big ones, actually. And FBX, we keep supporting FBX as well because it's there.
And OBJ.
It's everywhere, right? And so
30 years later.
Exactly. And so, right. But it's ours. And by the way, going back also to one of the things I was saying about Adobe, we it's not always been true, but anyway, I like standards. I like to support many standards that help again the ecosystem. Again, because I feel not only because I feel it's the way we feel in the team very much, very profoundly. We like to support the ecosystem, but also because if I want to just wear my businessman hat, right now the state of the industry imposes that we connect well with the rest of the industry because we're not in a stage where we can say, well, we take it all and we close. It doesn't work that way, and we would just fail. So to me it'd be an error, basically.
So Seb, Substance was a pretty early adopter of GLTF. It was actually pretty eye-opening for us because, you know, we designed GLTF first to be really efficient runtime, and then we saw that Substance first added import for GLTF. And we said, wait a minute, I guess there's so many GLTF in the wild that people don't just want to export, but they also want to import. Have you ever thought about it from that angle?
Yes. One of the objectives there was to support platforms like Sketchfab, right? So you had, basically what we want, Sketchfab, the good friends. And so what we always wanted to do, we've seen this number of objects and we thought, okay, it's actually great because one of the hardest thing to do in 3D is to actually model and create something. But one of the funniest thing to do is actually paint, and 3D paint, especially with Substance Painter. So one way for us to open up the ability for people to start using Substance Painter, having fun very quickly without having to go through the very tedious phase of creating something or finding something, was to connect from within Substance Painter to a platform like Sketchfab and then import a GLTF. And then paint over it, right? And so this is also why we developed the auto UV framework. So in case there was no UVs, so it was a way for us to bring more people into Substance Painter, and have fun very quickly, right? And so that was one of the original thinking behind it. And then we realized, well, I mean, like, it's a format, so it should be flowing as easy as possible.
Yeah, and one of the point that Patrick and I, you know, we try to propose is that, you know, GLTF is good transmission format, UZ is good authoring format. Let's at least evolve them in parallel in a way that is compatible and synchronized. So let's make sure that we actually talk. And, you know, when we start adding, you know, variants and physics and logic, let's make sure we do it in a way that, you know, it remains natural and it's easy to generate a GLTF from a USD and try to build on top of that complementarity as much as possible. So hopefully we get to show some of that and we get to make some of those things happen. That's one of our goals here. So
yeah, I agree. It's important. We should make sure that we use our position to somehow voice that loud enough so that it doesn't break and doesn't die.
Yeah, no, look, we've talked to, you know, a number of people from a number of companies, and I think we all think the same thing. The interdependence, as you said, nobody can be successful on their own. And so we're going to have to. And I think that guys like Kronos, guys like the Linux Foundation, you have a number of people who are pushing, you know, for that commonality. And we have places like SIGGRAPH where like neutral places when we all go. So I think it's just a matter of us taking our own fate in our own hands and going for it. So, well, Sébastien, thank you. It's on this topic, I think it's as you know, it's something dear and near to our heart here on the podcast. So, Patrick, you want to go through some closing questions?
For sure. So, Seb, we covered a lot of ground today, but was there anything we didn't talk about that you'd like to?
Yeah, I think the metaverse actually is crazy. It's like this curve. Like you, as a business owner, you're always trying to find like what is the next big wave we need to catch. And so, one thing I see in the metaverse is that we've all read the novels, we've all played MMOs, so we're not surprised by it, right? And so, what I'm surprised by is the speed at which people got into, express interest and like the amount of money that is invested and the amount of noise it's generating. So that means that we'll crash at some point. But anyway, and then we'll come back. What I think is interesting is like people now realize that at some point, like the same way the internet came and say it's a fad and it will disappear and then came back and now we don't even think about it. Like, I think the metaverse eventually will be something like this, or these like expanded version of the web, potentially mostly 3D, partly in 3D, potentially interactive, potentially immersive. But that's huge, in fact. And yeah, it's great that we're at the beginning of that. It's potentially a second golden age that we're at the beginning of right now. And so we're lucky, Mark.
No, I feel the same. We try to remind ourselves it's the beginning because the past 30 years of and how much, you know, how much work it has been to get to where we are today from both the visual effects industry and the game industry. And we haven't solved, even on texturing, we can barely exchange materials. There's so many problems to solve. So when you see the frenzy from investors and yes, we know it's big, we know it's going to be important, but it's going to take time too. And then we know that we also have to pay homage to, the 30 years of work from, those industries because they are creating the enabling technology that we are there today. That's why we try to invite on the podcast people who actually have made a difference in computer graphics because they've laid the foundation of the metaverse and they will play a big role moving forward. But it's the amount of work is humbling, but the potential is mind-boggling.
Seb, to wrap things up, we talked about how collaborative the industry is. Did you want to give a shout out to anyone or any organization?
I'm pretty excited by the way Adobe is embracing the thing right now. I'm not saying that because I'm there, but like it's interesting and I don't know. I like what NVIDIA is doing also, I have to say. I'm very impressed by what you guys are doing, I have to say. There are many companies that I'm like, okay, wow, that's actually pretty impressive and pretty alive, right? There is a lot of energy and a lot of passion, I can see.
That's a great sign.
Yeah. And to Mark's point, like, I guess it's a lot of like people driving this are coming from the same background and if competing, of course, still we love like playing the games and just watching the movies, right? So we have the same pleasure doing that.
Yeah, no, you're right. The community is special. And I think it's something worth shooting out to. So, well, Sébastien, thank you so much. Dr. De Guy, you said your mom likes you to be called you Dr. De Guy, so I'll call you Dr. De Guy to close. It was a pleasure to have you. Congrats on the acquisition. Congrats on everything you've been doing at Adobe, because the speed at which you guys come out with things is amazing. So you probably have a thing or two to do with that. So congratulations on this as well. And a big thank you to you, Patrick, to be there with us today again and helping me and helping us with all those technology and questions and everything. And a big thank you to our audience. Because we have people like Sébastien, people really like to hear from the folks from the industry. So we're lucky that we have very good guests, and so we get very good feedback. But keep us telling us what you think, the people you want to hear from. Hit us on social, let us know feedbacks, and do all those things you're supposed to do. Like, subscribe, and whatever. So Patrick and Sébastien, it was a pleasure. Thank you, and thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.